Well, my message today is about forgiveness. Now, please, before you check out, thinking this is just another Pastor Bill snoozers, okay? I want you to think about this for a second. Forgiveness is to Christianity like the golf ball is to the game of golf. Or gasoline is to the internal combustion engine. If without them, driving is impossible. You can't do it. A round of golf isn't going to happen without a golf ball. In my case, I'm going to need I'll need a whole long sleeve of golf balls to get me through 18 holes of golf. And my little jalopy sitting out in front of my house, it's going to have to transport me to the golf course. I don't have there's not a golf course right here in town. I have to go out into the country. And if my gas tank is empty, how am I going to get out there? I guess I could use my thumb if I want. The same is true for the relationship between forgiveness and Christianity. Christianity doesn't work, and it won't work, without forgiveness. I bring up this topic of forgiveness today simply because it's addressed in Psalm chapter 32. David begins the psalm writing, "Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him." Boy, I'll tell you what. I mean, if I start counting up my sins on a daily basis, I'm going to have to be some sort of a mathematician genius. And in verse 5, David says, "I will confess my transgressions before the Lord, and you forgave my guilt of my sin." Do you know how it is when things are so common in life that we almost forget that they are there? Take the oxygen we breathe, the water we drink, the electricity. Life works when we have these elements so readily available. When we go to bed at night, when we crash on the bed, we wrap ourselves in the blankets, and we're thankful for our mattress that's holding us up. But it never occurs to us to ask the question, because we're going to be, you know, comatose for the next 8 hours. Did you ever think to yourself, will I have enough oxygen tonight to get through 8 hours of sleep? No, we don't ask that. The same is true for water. As Michiganders, when you look on the map, we see we're surrounded by the wonderful Great Lakes. What a awesome blessing that is. And when we go to the sink and we turn on the faucet, do we ever ask the question to ourselves, well, I wonder if I'll get water today, or will I get something else? No, it's so common, it's so accessible, it's so readily available. And because of that, we rarely give it a thought. Goes right out of our minds, typically. Could it be that this is how we view forgiveness as Christians? Forgiveness is so readily available. Jesus says, just call on my name, I will forgive you. I'm a righteous and just God. Thank you, Lance. Appreciate that. We don't have to think, we don't think about forgiveness so much because it's so readily available. And because we don't think about it, do we forget about it? Or worse yet, do we lose the value, our understanding of its value, the understanding of the value of forgiveness? Maybe we think that forgiveness is so commonplace that it's like the leaves on the trees. Sometimes we think it's so common, we can afford to withhold it from others. Did you ever do that before? To withhold forgiveness. Almost like we use it as leverage over somebody. And we might say to ourselves, oh, they'll find another source of forgiveness. Yes, they offended me and I should forgive them for what they did. But I'm not going to forgive them. It's sort of like when we go to Walmart and we decide, oh, I don't like Walmart, I'll go somewhere else and I can go to Kroger and get my groceries instead. They'll find another source of forgiveness. I don't have to forgive them. Many times, think about this for a second, we are the only source of forgiveness a person has because, well, they sinned against us. So we are the ones that have to forgive them. The neighbor's not going to forgive them for the sin they committed against us. We have to forgive them. And yes, God will forgive them too. But we, in a sense, we kind of hold that power. Sometimes we may actually use our reluctance to forgive, our non-forgiveness as leverage, as I said earlier. Have you ever said to yourself, I'll forgive him when I'm convinced he's truly sorry for what he did against me, or she did against me? Can that even be classified as forgiveness? I don't think so. Did the father of the prodigal son forgive the son only after he came back and confessed his sin? Of course not. In his heart, the father had already forgiven him long before the prodigal son came to his senses and said, I must return home to my father. When the prodigal son returned home, the father had already forgiven him. And we know this because the father was already searching for the son the very moment the son left to go on his journey to begin with. And when he was far away and he saw him on the horizon, the father ran to the son. And even before it was out of his mouth, he said, Father, I have sinned against you and against God. In his heart, the father had already forgiven him. So I guess what I'm trying to point out this morning is that I never want us. We can never forget or fail to realize as Christians how incredibly good we have it because of God's willingness and His desire and His power to forgive us. Just as David said in Psalm 32, blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Happy, content, full of joy, relief. My sins are forgiven. Wow. We are all blessed today because God stands ready and able to forgive our sins. When we think about it, forgiveness is really the dominant and repetitive theme throughout the Bible. It can even be inferred in the conversation the Trinity had among itself before creation. The sentence, let us make man in our image, presupposes forgiveness in at least two ways, right at the beginning. First, it reminds us that forgiveness is fundamentally relational. Forgiveness is relational. It requires at least two people, right? There's got to be the offender and the one who is offended. Or as they say back in the 20th century, there was the sinner. They don't use that word anymore. There's a sinner and there's a victim. And there is a relationship there. And when the sin comes in, it's broken. And so forgiveness needs to take place for that relationship to be restored. This is the fundamental and essential message of the Bible. No, I'm not saying God's sin, okay? Don't get me wrong. You have the sinner, you have the victim. God didn't sin. I only make the point that the triune God in His very nature is relational because He's three in one, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And since we are made, it says in the Scriptures, that we are made in God's image, we too are to be relational and by consequence have the capacity to forgive as God does. Not in its completeness and fullness as God forgives us, but we do, at least on a creaturely level, as being God's creatures, we have the ability to forgive one another. And we should use that ability whenever possible. It's the Christian, it's the character, it's the fundamental characteristic of Christians to love and forgive. That's why when the Lord Jesus taught His disciples to pray, they asked Him, Lord, teach us to pray. He included, forgive us our trespasses as we have trespassed against each other. Secondly, God's act of creating humans infers forgiveness because God gave us free will. He gave us the freedom to choose between right and wrong, good and evil. So God knew from the very beginning that forgiveness would have to be an essential part to bring man's into restoration and salvation. Just because when he made us, he said, you're going to have free will. You get to choose. And God knew from the very beginning how we were going to choose. We were going to go against him. We were going to try to be our own God. We were going to try to hide ourselves when we sin. Hide from God. But we can't do that. And so we get a clear glimpse, even at the beginning of the Bible in Genesis chapter 3, about God's forgiveness towards mankind, that even after he cursed the serpent, and he cursed the ground, and he announced the consequences of Adam's sin to the world, what did it say? What action did God take? He said, he actually acted, he made garments of sin for Adam and Eve, and cared for them. Garments of skin. God made garments of skin for Adam and Eve and clothed them. And when you think about it, that is really what forgiveness is all about. Covering one's sin. The one who was offended, the one who was sinned against, now this is the idea of, again, forgiveness. The one who is sinned against willingly bears the burden of the sin and pays the cost of the sin themselves so that the relationship between the two parties can somehow be restored and continue on in harmony. The one who is sinned against says, I will bear the cost and the burden of the sin. That's hard to do, isn't it? Because we so often want the person who has offended us to hurt. We want them to be punished for what they did to us. But that's not a forgiving attitude. A forgiving attitude says, I will take on the burden and the cost of what you did to me, and I'm not going to hold it against you. I think when I took a counseling class in seminary, and the one picture that sticks in my mind is the idea that when someone sins against you and you have that relationship there, you are kind of linked together with chain. And until you forgive them, that chain remains. When you say, I forgive, then the chain comes off. Well, God paid the price way back then, even in Genesis chapter 3. He took part of his own creation, he took animals, living animals, and he spilled their blood in order to provide Adam and Eve cover. It was a way of caring for them. And it wasn't that Adam and Eve's nakedness was shameful, because they were already, in the garden without clothes and unashamed, right? And so it wasn't that Adam and Eve's nakedness was shameful, and so God made them clothes to cover them up. It was because their bodies were no longer covered by God's glory. That's kind of what, remember we talk about when the people of Israel always did some things that were displeasing and dishonoring and sinful against the Lord? The presence of God would leave the temple. And there they would be, all their shame for everybody to see. And that's kind of what happened in the garden, I think. This is my understanding, maybe. Their bodies were no longer covered with God's glory, which, when you think about it, is the best cover to have, God's glory. In a true and tangible way, God's glory could no longer rest on Adam and Eve because of their sin, and so a temporary alternative had to suffice until the day when all believers will be clothed in God's righteousness. And then new clothing. Isaiah chapter 61, 10. This goes back to Psalm 32 in a sense. I delight greatly in the Lord. My soul rejoices in God, for he has clothed me with garments of salvation. He arrayed me in robes of righteousness. Our sin is covered. Our shame is not exposed anymore. It is covered by the glory of God. Isaiah can write this about God and His forgiveness toward mankind because God gave Isaiah a vision of what the year of the Lord's favor looks like. The burden of humanity's sin was to be carried and paid for by the Messiah Himself, so that our relationship, as we talk about, the relationship between, well, God and man, our relationship with God, our relationship with human to human. It could be restored. We know the familiar verses of Isaiah 53. He took up our infirmities. He carried our sorrows. He was considered stricken by God, smitten by Him, afflicted, but He was pierced. He was crushed for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brings us peace was put upon Him. And by His wounds we are healed. So God's offer of forgiveness, it's just like David said, it is really the greatest blessing to all humanity. Because it comes out of God's love, right? If we choose to appropriate it. We have to take it. It's there, but are we going to receive it? When we do, we have a wonderful sense of comfort and peace and joy and amazement that God would do something like that for us. And now we have a wonderful personal loving relationship with our Creator. Forever and ever. Now, I don't know about you, but doesn't that sound good? That sounds terrific to me. That's what Franklin Graham's going to talk about, I'm sure, on the 29th and every place he goes. He extends the offer of God's forgiveness to a humanity, to people, to you and me, who need it desperately. There's one, has anybody seen the movie The Mission? It's a mission. Robert De Niro played this reformed slave ship captain. And he was a Jesuit priest. He became a Jesuit. First he was a slave owner or a ship captain. He was bringing slaves over to America. And he finally saw the light. God saved him. And so he's going back to start a mission in the same area where he used to go and collect slaves and bring them to where, I don't know if it was America or Britain or wherever, but anyway, as he's going through this island, he has this sense of burden, and he's got a whole bag of equipment that he had used to enslave the slaves. And he's carrying it through the jungle sort of thing because it's like his penance. And he's climbing up this major hill and he can't get up the hill because of all the weight that he's trying to carry. And he won't take it off because, again, he feels like this is his penance. He's got to do that. Well, as he's climbing up the hill, there's a big, strong, black native there ready to... He's got a huge machete and he's ready to... It looks like he's going to, you know, take his head off because he recognizes this guy and what he's done. But instead of killing this man, he slices the rope and his burdens fall off. And when I was a younger Christian, I thought, well, that's a neat picture of forgiveness. I like that. I can relate with that. I mean, I can't relate with it, but I can understand it. But then I said, where did all that weight go? All that stuff that left, where did it go? I mean, I don't think it wasn't a complete picture of forgiveness. Because I wanted to know all that stuff that was on him and was set free and went crashing down the hill. Where did it go? So I'm going to read this. This is from Walter Wangerin. I don't know if you might have heard this. You ever hear the, raise your hand if you ever heard the story called The Rag Man. Anybody heard The Rag Man? Really? Wow, it's amazing. I'm surprised. I heard this way back in the 1980s. And it struck with me ever since. I'll read it to you. I saw a strange sight. I stumbled upon a story most strange, like nothing in my life. My street sense, my sly tongue had ever prepared me for. I will tell it to you. Even before dawn, one Friday morning, I noticed a young man, handsome and strong, walking the alleys of our city. He was pulling an old cart filled with clothes, both bright and new, and he was calling in a clear tenor voice, "Rags!" Ah, the air was foul and the first light filthy to be crossed by such sweet music. "Rags, new rags for old. I take your tired rags." Now this is a wonder, I thought to myself, for the man stood 6'4", and his arms were like tree limbs, hard and muscular, and his eyes flashed intelligence. Can he find no better job than this, to be a rag man in the inner city? I followed him. My curiosity drove me, and I wasn't disappointed. Soon the rag man saw a woman sitting on her back porch. She was sobbing into a handkerchief, sighing, and shedding 1,000 tears. Her knees and elbows made a sad X. Her shoulders shook. Her heart was breaking. The rag man stopped his cart. Quietly he walked to the woman, stepping around tin cans, dead toys, and Pampers. "Give me your rag," he said. "I'll give you another." He slipped the handkerchief from her eyes. She looked up, and he laid across her palm a linen cloth so clean and new that it shined. She blinked from the gift to the giver. Then, as he began to pull his cart again, the rag man did a strange thing. He put her stained handkerchief to his own face, and then he began to weep, to sob as grievously as she had done, his shoulders shaking. Yet she was left without a tear. "This is a wonder," I breathed to myself. I followed the sobbing rag man like a child who could not turn away from mystery. "Rags! Rags! New rags for old!" In a little while, when the sky showed gray behind the rooftops, and I could see the shredded curtains hanging out black windows, the rag man came upon a girl whose head was wrapped in a bandage, whose eyes were empty, blood soaked from her bandage. A single line of blood ran down her cheek. Now the tall rag man looked upon this child with pity. He drew a lovely yellow bonnet from his cart. "Give me your rag," he said, tracing his own line on her cheek, "and I'll give you mine." The child could only gaze at him while he loosened the bandage, removed it, tied it to his own head. The bonnet he set on hers, and I gasped at what I saw. For with the bandage went the wound. Against his brow it ran a darker, more substantial blood, his own. "Rags! Rags! I take old rags!" cried the sobbing, bleeding, strong, intelligent ragman. The sun hurt both the sky now in my eyes, and the ragman seemed more and more to hurry. "Are you going to work?" he asked a man who leaned against the telephone pole. The man shook his head. The rag man pressed him. "Do you have a job?" "Are you crazy?" sneered the other. He pulled away from the pole, revealing the right sleeve of his jacket, flat, the cuff stuffed into the pocket. He had no arm. "So," said the rag man, "give me your jacket. I will give you mine." So much quiet authority in his voice. The one-armed man took off his jacket. So did the rag man. And I trembled at what I saw, for the rag man's arm stayed in its sleeve, and when the other put it on, he had two good arms, thick as tree limbs. But the rag man had only one. "Go to work," he said. And after that, he found a drunk lying unconscious beneath an army blanket, an old man hunched, wizened, and sick, and he took the blanket and wrapped it around himself. But the drunk, he left new clothes. And now I had to run to keep up with the rag man, though he was weeping uncontrollably and bleeding freely at the forehead, pulling his cart with one arm, stumbling for dark drunkenness, falling again and again, exhausted, old and sick. Yet he went with terrible speed. On spider's leg, he skittered through the alleys of the city, this mile and the next, until he came to its limits, and then he rushed beyond. And I wept to see the change in this man. I hurt to see his sorrow, and yet I needed to see where he was going in such haste, perhaps to know what drove him so. The little old rag man, he came to a landfill. He came to the dark garbage pits, and I wanted to help him in what he did, but I hung back, hiding. He climbed a hill. With tormented labor, he cleared a little space on that hill. Then he sighed. He laid down. He pillowed his head on a handkerchief and a jacket. He covered his bones with an army blanket. And then he died. Oh, how I cried to witness that death. I slumped in a junk car and wailed and mourned as one who has no hope, because I had come to love the ragman. Every other face had faded in the wonder of this man, and I cherished him. But he died. I sobbed myself to sleep. I did not know. How could I know that I slept through Friday night and Saturday, and it's night too. But then on Sunday morning, I was awakened by a violent light, pure, hard, demanding light, slammed against my sour face, and I blinked and I looked and I saw the first wonder of it all. There, the rag man, folding the blankets most carefully, a scar on his forehead, but alive, and besides that, healthy. There was no sign of sorrow or age, and all the rags that he had gathered shined for cleanliness. Well, then I lowered my head, and I trembled for all that I had seen, and I myself walked up to the rag man. I told him my name with shame, for I was a sorry figure next to him. Then I took off my clothes, and in that place, and I said to him, with dear yearning in my voice, "Dress me." And he dressed me. My Lord, he put new rags on me, and I'm a wonder beside him. The rag man, the Christ.